Welcome to the Consulting Success Podcast with your host, Michael Zapersky, where we take you deep into the world of elite consultants.
Hey, it's Michael Zapersky, and today I'm very excited to have Stuart Friedman from Global Context joining us. Stuart, welcome.
Thank you very much, Michael. Pleasure.
So, Stuart, for those of you that are, you know, people on the line here listening in today that don't know you, just take a few seconds and introduce yourself. Let us know kind of what your area of expertise is and where you're based.
Sure, absolutely. I'm here in Silicon Valley. Been in this area for, about 20, 30 years, originally from New York. Have a degree in electrical engineering and always had an inkling for theater. And in fact, it's kind of funny. I picked to go to Carnegie Mellon because I thought it was a good way for me to do engineering and science and math, and also at the same time, maybe study lighting design. Well, little did I know that that doesn't happen at CMU. They're mutually exclusive entities. But I got a degree in engineering, went right into the semiconductor industry when I graduated. Mm-hmm. And then I went, always had an affinity for marketing. And so product marketing then took me to sales at Intel. Back in the early 80s. And throughout all my experiences, what I was exposed to growing up in the suburbs of New York in theater were lots of cross-cultural situations, whether mm-hmm. it was South Pacific, King and I, Pacific Overtures, West Side Story, Fiddler on the Roof. And so I always looked for opportunities in technology to travel, and never knowing that ultimately I would make that the center of my career. So I spent most of my time in the semiconductors. I then went on to become, in my last corporate role, the vice president general manager of the cable modem business at a company here in the Valley called Terrion. Mm-hmm. And in the time I was there, we grew that substantially in a very difficult market. And it was through that experience that I think two things happened, Michael. One was, first, I realized that what I had picked up over all those years about how different cultures cognitively impacted somebody's cognitive abilities was really pretty profound. And so I used that to my advantage to build relationships, mm-hmm. build trust, and close deals. Then something very eventful happened. I was on a business trip and a piece of luggage fell on my head. It knocked me completely out, and I was stuttering for 3 months in speech therapy and neuropsychology testing. And through that process, I became very in touch with something that as an engineer you take for granted, and that is the ability to communicate and the ability to process cognitively. And it was through that experience that I realized, you know what I should be doing? I should be embracing everything I've learned about culture and using my new insights about communicating. And so hence Global Context was then, long story, Global Context was born, and that was about 12 years ago now. And in the last dozen or so years, I've been working in all aspects of cultural communications, whether it be across cultures, whether it be multicultural teams within this one company, mm-hmm. or whether it be the cultural differences that are always apparent and many times the killer of many a merger and acquisition.
Right. So, I mean, that's a very interesting path, because you talked about, you know, coming from an engineering background, then into marketing and into sales, you know, mixing theater into that, but really it sounds like the interest of culture is what more than maybe the, what would you say it's more than your actual experience? Was it just the interest in culture that, and the experience of this luggage kind of knocking you out for a little bit that really spawned Global Context? Or would you say that it came from the marketing and sales? Because I've been, you know, going from marketing and sales to cross-cultural, like a focus on cross-cultural in your business, they're definitely, I mean, there's, I'm sure, you know, connections, but they are very different. So what would you say really got you to the decision of, okay, I'm going to focus on building a consultancy around cross-cultural communication?
Yeah. So I had take a leave of absence from work when my immediate family was having some health issues. Mm-hmm. And when I stepped away from work, I got a call from a previous competitor. And he said he was sorry to hear that we were working through these issues. But if I wanted on a part-time basis, he would love to have me do some consulting for him. And from a technology standpoint, right. I thought. And I said, well, if your idea of my consulting for you as a former competitor was to hand over confidential information, I'm not so interested. And that's when he said something to me that really was the single inflection point. He said, no, what we really want to know from you, Stuart, is how did you take away all our business in Asia?
Mm.
What was it that you know about cultural differences that we haven't learned? And I had been studying it. I had started to realize that there was a lot of frameworks and models that explain culture that for some reason just didn't make its way out of academia and as strongly into the corporate world, but not so much that I would ever make it a personal investment in my career until the gentleman stepped forward and became my first client and was in fact for my client for 5 years, and then through two subsequent acquisitions where I consulted on the cultural integration of his company and the acquirer.
Right.
So that's really how it happened. There's been no turning back. I think it's fascinating to me, Michael, to realize with as much of an affinity that I thought I had for cultural differences and making them work for me, I'm amazed here we are a dozen years later, how much I never knew that I didn't know
mm-hmm.
back
right.
when I was on the job.
Yeah. Well, I want to come back and explore, you know, the area of culture a little bit more and kind of how it connects, you know, to building your business. But before we go there, you know, when I look at your client list, I know it includes like Apple, Sony, Microsoft, Nissan, Oracle, right? Many other well-known companies. Were you always working with larger brands? I mean, was that from day one of your consultancy, or was that more of a transition and you start off with smaller or more mid-sized companies as clients?
Yeah, so I mean, I like the mix. Obviously, the larger clients take a little bit more time. There are higher client acquisition costs, mm-hmm. let's say, and you can spend a lot of time pursuing them only to then, you know, reach some level in the company where the guy, you know, I may have a great interaction with people at one level where they know the cultural skills will make all the difference in the world. But, you know, it's a funny thing. As you go up in the organization to more experienced people and more accomplished people, you also find that the blind spots get bigger. I mean, they're convinced they're in that role because they already understand the way the world works. And to take somebody who's had some tremendous success in a homogenous environment, and now they're dealing with other cultures, sometimes they get it, sometimes they don't.
Mm-hmm.
So to your point, that can be a laborious effort dealing with the big accounts. Fortunately for me, I think a lot of the bigger accounts that I've had as clients have come to me because some smaller accounts or people that I've worked with in the past happen to move on to the bigger accounts. So when I got them and when I maintained them, it was because there really wasn't any client acquisition time involved. It was mm-hmm. somebody joined who already knew me, and that just greased the skids.
So would you say that you haven't really had to do much marketing at all? Like it hasn't been an intentional kind of plan or strategy that you've used to win accounts or business from, you know, these large kind of global multinationals? It's just been through referrals in your network?
Yeah, I would say if I look at my revenue over the last dozen or so years, yeah, I'd say the majority of it has come through personal contacts and referrals. But that said, I think there probably could have been, I don't know, I go back and forth. Could it have been greater growth if I put more effort into business development?
Mm.
I'm not sure, because for the work that I do, the space that I'm in, which is trying to tell people that don't think they've ever had a problem, that they've got a problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lofty goal. So, I'm not sure that doing a lot of marketing to the extent of acquiring new clients directly, was valuable. But what I will tell you is very valuable is, when I've, written blogs for now, Fortune magazine, Fortune.com, right, or Business Insider, or been interviewed in other places, I find that those opportunities, while they don't cast a huge net and get more people to come in, when I am pursuing a deal, it'll absolutely be accelerated by that. So if it gets to a certain level where somebody has said, hey, we really ought to get Stuart in, and then the C staff goes out to my website or sees something that I've written or some accomplishment that I've had, then from an acceleration standpoint of client acquisition,
right,
it's been invaluable, right?
So it's more like confirmation is how it aids them in making the decision that choosing you is the right choice.
I think so. I think that's been extremely helpful. Yeah.
Have you taken, so are there specific steps from a marketing or business development perspective that you have taken? I mean, aside from writing articles on your own website or in some other publications, like you mentioned Fortune or Business Insider, have you done any other kind of marketing that you feel has really helped your business over the years?
In the broad sense of marketing, maybe what I've done is that's really helped me is probably keeping a good bandwidth of communications with all those who I've had the good fortune to either work with or to have be a client. And if something was happened in the news, I'd immediately write up a blog about it, how the culture got impacted. So I'd say that most of my marketing efforts have been maybe to continue to embrace those people who already know me so that they then serve as my best champions and advocates out there.
Right. Okay. Makes sense. You know, you said something very interesting, Stuart, which is that you work with, in some cases, companies who don't think they have a problem, right, around kind of cross-cultural communication or just cultural issues. And so your role is to convince them or somehow get them to see that there is a problem. How do you do that? Because I think a lot of consultants, you know, are dealing with issues or are, you know, experienced in areas where there is real value, but sometimes it's hard to convey that value to buyers because it may not be as high on their priority list as, let's say, you know, growing sales and revenue,
sure,
or decreasing costs.
Sure.
Like culture is, in some ways, people see it as a soft skill. It's not as tangible. It's maybe considered to be like a harder sell. So you've been able to obviously move the needle and win significant business over the years. So how have you been able to do that? What's your approach and your advice for someone who maybe is dealing with an area that is a bit of a softer skill and not as tangible or maybe high priority on an executive's agenda as growing sales and revenue?
Sure. Great question. Let me kind of address it this way, which I think sitting here as a soft skill guy in the middle of the hardest of all skills, the Silicon Valley, I've had to deal with some very interesting paradoxes. The thing that I always find surprising is, you know, you meet a CEO of a reasonably sized company, and he'll tell you about or he'll tell his board or the street about their technology, maybe their IP. He'll talk about the experience and talents of his people. He'll talk about his operational excellence and all these wonderful things. And then no sooner does he talk about all that, you find out that they missed a revenue goal, that their expenses were higher than they should have been,
mm-hmm,
that the forecasts coming in from the field weren't accurate and there were some surprises. And so where do those things happen? Why, with all the talent and all the brilliance and all the technology, why are these companies missing their goals? And that's the paradox, because that is the result of soft skills.
Mm.
It's the human issues that when all is said and done, and you've got the technology and you've got the brilliance, it's in fact the human issues that bog everything down. And I'll tell you, Michael, one of the things that I've learned in the time I've been doing this was what it is that I'm addressing. You know, if I go out and I wave the cultural flag to people who think culture, as you said, is so soft, then yeah, I'm going to shoot myself in the foot. So mm-hmm. What I've found is a much more compelling value to people at any level in a company is for me to talk at a higher level of where the impact is, the human issues impact the bottom line.
Right.
And those issues are very simple. It's miscommunications, it's resource alignment, and it's trust. And when those three things are endemic in an organization, it doesn't matter how bright the people are and how much technology they have, there's going to be problems. And while I don't say it up front, trust, resource alignment, misunderstandings are the result of cultural differences more often than not.
I think that's a really great reminder, because a lot of people who are dealing in an area that may be a bit of a softer skill or less tangible from some perspective, they often try and almost persuade. They have this idea that they have to persuade the market to see things their way because the market, is not understanding the opportunity. But I really like how, this reminder that you're sharing with us, Stuart, it's about figuring out what does the market care about? So how do you take your area of expertise and where you can really add value and then kind of reposition or position it in a way that it aligns with what the market actually wants so that you can then put yourself in the position to have a deeper and more meaningful conversation.
Absolutely. I once heard, and I don't remember where, but I once heard somebody say something that's really stuck with me. And that was, what you really want to do as a sales guy or as a marketing guy or just an entrepreneur is, sure, you can wake up every day and try to convince somebody that they need something that they don't think they need.
Mm-hmm.
But wouldn't it be a lot more fun to figure out what keeps them up at night and then talk to them about how you can solve that problem?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Yeah, it's probably a mistake that many people make. How about you, Stuart? So, I mean, you've built your business now to a level of great success. You've been doing this for a while. Many consultants, as we know, experience challenges along the way. What's maybe one or two challenges that stand out for you that you remember were opportunities for you to learn, like mistakes maybe that you made or challenges that you encountered? What really stands out looking back?
Sure. Yeah, I guess there's so many different ways to answer that. I guess one way to do it is, and what I'm about to say doesn't come with any bitterness at all. It just comes with a pragmatic observation of maybe, lessons learned and how not to repeat it. And that is that, I've really enjoyed the companies that I work for, whether they were small startup entrepreneurial companies or whether they were, large Fortune 100 companies. But it was very naive of me to think in each one of those opportunities that company really cared about me, that they really had my best interests at heart. Let's face it, we all know how many people I had to at one point or another get on my team when I was in a corporation. And you focus on the good points and you kind of tamper down the skeletons back in the closet. You have to build a team. You have to stay focused. You have no choice.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is, I think I was naive in thinking that the company had my best interests in mind. And while I would have never said it out loud to anybody, maybe inside I thought that one day somebody would turn to me at one of these corporations and say, Stuart, you'd make a great entrepreneur and you ought to be going to do being a, you ought to go be a consultant and you're going to do great. Nobody cares about that. It's all, having you be part of the system. And so, frankly, that's what comes kind of back to the head injury that I had had is, you know, maybe I needed a good smack in the head to realize, wait, there's a lot more going on in this world than just being a cog in the corporate wheel. So I think the lesson learned is for people, I think I could have saved myself a lot more time getting up the learning curve or the so-called 10,000 hours to becoming a, you know, an expert. Mm-hmm. If I had realized while I was still on the corporate job, how to plant all those seeds and prepare for the inevitable day that I would be out on my own. I think now about all those millions of frequent flyer miles that I have. And instead of watching the in-flight movie, I should have been researching things that would have given me stronger and quicker legs to go out and make a change.
Right. And what would one of those be? So, you know, if we may kind of reposition the question a little bit to maybe a mistake, a learning experience that you see a lot of other consultants and experts making, what is maybe one mistake that stands out to you that you just – you know, think to yourself, wow, like, you know, why are so many people making that mistake? Like, you know, they don't need to, there is a better way or a clear path. Like, is there one that stands out for you?
Yeah, there really is. And I think it's, and to a certain extent, it's back to the question you asked me earlier about marketing, mm-hmm. because I'm now in a position where I'm putting much more effort into certain marketing than before. And of course, having been part of the corporate world, mm-hmm. my go-to market, my sales approach was all based on what gets commonly referred to as OEM sales, right? I was selling a component to a manufacturer.
Right.
If he was building a product, he had a space for either mine or my competitor's product. And integral part of that is, you know, you just service the hell out of the account. You build the relationships. You know where the power balance is within that company, and you do everything you can to meet their needs.
Mm-hmm.
But as a consultant, you can't afford to do that. So no matter how much I try to nurse an opportunity to success, the client acquisition costs are just way too high and time is too short. So lesson learned was it took me much longer to transition my business into something that achieves a higher level of fees and less trying to grow the business by realizing that it's no longer for me about pursuing the heck out of an account and trying to close it as it was for most of my career. It's now my putting some messaging out there, and the people who are interested will call me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the fundamental difference. I don't want to chase an opportunity anymore as I did early on. I want people to say, hey, I read what you wrote. I heard this interview with Michael. You had a media presence that really intrigued me. And I think that's where the best opportunities for a consultant comes from is when the guy's already convinced he needs your services. And what can you do to put that message out there and not worry about who it is that's actually going to call? People who like what they hear will call.
Right. And does that mean, I mean, just to be very clear here for all our listeners, you know, are you suggesting that people don't do follow-up or that they don't make calls or do any kind of outreach to, you know, to prospective clients?
Absolutely you want to do that, because at the end of the day, it's all about the relationships and mm-hmm. and making that connection.
Yep.
But there's a point where you do it as a integral part of the normal sales process. And there's a point where you take no prisoners and you say, hell or high water, I'm going to close this deal, damn it. And that's what becomes ultimately too time consuming.
Right.
So I routinely will follow through. I'll put somebody in a tickler file. I'll say, hey, is there an opportunity to come in? I just developed some new material on something I'd love to update you on. And but I kind of put that on the low burner.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because the real exciting opportunities are going to come when somebody says, "How soon can you come out here? We got an issue."
Right. Yeah, I would certainly agree with that, Stuart. I think there's a lot of consultants out there that spend far too much time, you know, chasing prospective buyers, only to realize that the prospective buyer either isn't the ultimate decision maker, or it's someone that isn't really that interested in buying right now. It's just not the right stage in the buying cycle for them, or they're just not committed. And so they kind of fool themselves into believing that they have this pipeline full of opportunity when really it's a lot, you know, slimmer than they think it is. So creating that kind of environment where you're able to have ideal clients reaching out to you because of your presence and because of the steps or the momentum that you've built is certainly a place that, that people should be working towards. So I think that's a great reminder.
That's exactly what I think will allow somebody to transition their business into something much greater and more successful than they ever imagined.
Yeah. What's your approach, Stuart, to kind of scaling and growing your business? I mean, do you have a team? Do you have productized offerings? How do you plan for growth in your business currently?
Sure. You know, I started this all back just before everything crashed in 2008 and 2009. And so, and it was very painful because I had, when I went off and did this, I immediately hired people I had known for a while. And of course, very painful in such a situation to when people have taken that chance to join to then mm-hmm. just to have to let them go. So, what I wanted to do this time was figure out a way to scale without necessarily building organizations. So I created a network of affiliates who are other consultants in other specialized areas that are synergistic with my area. So, for example, somebody in Brazil who focuses specifically on relocations and expats.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody turns out in Finland who advises the Finnish who people when they go to other parts of the world about other cultures, but then they need somebody over here. So one of my clients being a Finnish expat based here.
Right. So yeah, what I heard you saying there, really what I took away from that is that the approach that you've used to be able to scale your business without a lot of resources or infrastructure and, you know, hiring a big team and so forth is building a network of affiliates, of partners and relationships that you can use as needed for different projects.
Absolutely. And I think the other part of that I was going to mention too was this transition in terms of what my deliverables have been in the past and where I'm trying to go in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously in the past, it was all about booking my hours. What is, you know, the consultant dilemma, right? What happens when all of a sudden now your time is booked? How do you grow? How do you, if you're not going to hire people, how do you scale? And so I am, in fact, very aggressively now working on developing product.
Mm.
And whether it be offering e-seminars, doing my own stuff or developing seminars for other people. I've actually even developed an app. I do a lot of work in helping people with presentation skills. English second language, foreign-born people here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
who, although they're very fluent in English, have never learned the nuance of giving a really good presentation in this environment and in this culture or in this language. And so through all the work that I've done with companies with PhDs and, say, biomedical and toxicology of pharmaceuticals. A lot of these people go to conferences and they deliver papers. And as brilliant as they are and as technical as they are, their presence at the conference is lacking. So I help them a lot with presentation skills. And in doing that, I found an opportunity to develop an app which allows somebody to practice a presentation in front of a live audience and get real-time feedback from them. The audience will enter input, put things into their phone, slow down, speed up, don't use your hands as much, And those answers, those will all light up on the speaker's, say, iPad as a dashboard. And so this app also offsets things too, because I use it as a matter of course in my work, and that also serves the purpose of then positioning this product. And so right. I've had this now on the market for a year, and I hope to use that as a beachhead for some other apps that are more culturally oriented.
Mm. Very interesting. Well, Stuart, thanks so much for coming on here today. I really appreciate you sharing your story. What's the best way for people to reach out to you and kind of learn more about your work?
Thanks for asking. By all means, my email address and my website, my email is Stuart, S-T-U-A-R-T, at global-context.com. And the website being the same domain, www.global-context.com.
Awesome. Well, we'll definitely point people there. And again, Stuart, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Michael. Appreciate the time.
Are you ready to take your consulting business to the next level? Learn more about the Accelerator Coaching Program at ConsultingSuccess.com.